Everybody hates methodology classes, including teachers, because it's so intimidating. So let's see what I can do. We've been learning a lot about the BBC and its huge political, social and cultural role in the life of the British people, and its impressive success in surviving many decades of political and market turmoil, and adapting to myriad changes in societies, defending in many ways the status quo at the same time as allowing space for many different voices. So today I want to talk a little bit about methodology based on some of the comments which juries marking the aggregation papers have come up with over the years. Thank you to these colleagues. In particular, I'm using the comments made by my colleague Françoise Bayet at a recent round table for teachers, which you were not allowed to come from. But let me first of all introduce my background today. This is a BBC Two ident from 1967, the first colour ident, BBC Colour. And it was extremely exciting to see the first television in colour. So that's why I thought I'd have this ident for today. Now, the first element of methodology is to have a very clear view of what is expected of you. And the reports of the last few years are available on the website of the SAES, the Société des Anglicistes de l'Enseignement Supérieur. They will help you. Now, a word of warning, they are very detailed and they aim very high. Very high. Even those who easily passed the aggregation last year did not avoid all of these mistakes. Yeah, so it's really, it's like, you know. So try not to be intimidated by them. But there are separate reports for the aggregation interne and the aggregation externe. However, the problems faced in the two cases are extremely similar. Otherwise, so put your questions into the chat as we go along. But before I start, I want to put methodology in its proper place. It is not supposed to be an arbitrary set of rules made up in order to make life harder for students. It is supposed to help you to present the knowledge you have in a structured and clear manner and to show, in this case, the breadth and depth of your thinking about the history of the BBC. Now, I'm going to talk about the BBC and methodology, but exactly the same problems apply to the other question which could come up in Civilisation, which is, of course, President Obama. President Obama is a bit... It's a different sort of subject because it's more cadre. On the other hand, it's more cadre for everybody. So because it's a competition, you know, it doesn't really, whether the questions are easy or hard doesn't really help you. You just have to be better than the other people. In particular, important thing about the methodology for a dissertation, and I'm going to look at the imaginary dissertation, the BBC and competition. That's our subject. Okay. Now, it's very, very important to say, if you take the question, the BBC and competition, frankly, you could easily write, not you, but somebody could easily write a 500-page book on the BBC and competition. It's not difficult at all. If I could do it. So, obviously, you're not supposed to cover the entire thing with all the aspects and examples. You just have to have a good sample of approaches, ideas and examples, enough to impress the jury more than the other people have impressed the jury. Okay, so you're not supposed to cover the whole subject. But it's particularly important to remember you are not trying to find the hidden secret answer, the hidden key question, the hidden problematique, which the jury has already decided on you must discover. Absolutely not. There are 10, 20, 30 possible good answers to this essay question, and indeed all essay questions. On the other hand, if you do not know much about the BBC and the history of the BBC, it won't really matter how good your methodology is, because you won't have the examples to put it in. Okay, so let me begin with two questions, which is, these are the ones that my colleague underlined. One is the scope of the question. That is the scope of the BBC topic and the framing document. There's text to Cat's Eyes, the framing document. And secondly, some of the favourite mistakes of candidates. And this is what Madame Baillet was talking about. She says, I've never been on the Agglomeration jury. She's been on the jury for many years, and she was saying, oh, these are the main things that they come up with. So first of all, the scope of the question, and she underlined that it is crucial when you're preparing to work on all aspects of the topic, all aspects, that is to say, all major aspects. And in the text of in the framing document, it's fairly clear that there are three aspects. First of all, the audiovisual sector in the UK. Secondly, the BBC and political power. Yeah, how does the BBC get on with government or not? And finally, cultural and social aspects of BBC activity. And she really underlined that all three must be studied. And if possible, in your answer, it's not always possible, but certainly in your answer, you introduce elements of at least two. That's very important. So if you take, first of all, the audiovisual sector, this means that you must know things about radio and television. Really, I'm pretty sure that if you write an answer to any question which is only about television, unless it says very clearly in the title, that's definitely a problem. And so for the BBC and competition, certainly if you write only about television, it would be better to stay at home that day. Remember that radio in many ways is more important. The radio begins in 1922, so millions of people in the 20s and 30s and 40s watch radio. And in the 50s, the whole of the 50s, radio was much more important than television. The BBC spent more money on radio in 53, 54, 55. So radio was really the big thing, and television was this new thing with a very little screen and not very sophisticated and only one channel. Remember, the BBC radio had three channels: the Home Service, the Light Programme, and the Third Programme in the 50s. So radio and television. And secondly, you need to, where, if at all possible, speak about before the war and after the war. Yeah, and not stick to one. Now, obviously, the story of the 60s, 70s, 80s is easier for you, because although it was a long time ago and it was the last century, at least people did like more normal things for your generation than in the 20s and 30s, which is really another world. It's really another world. The other thing that Madame Baillet underlined is that she said you do need to know about the historical background of the period 1922 to 95. You're expected to know the history, the general strike in 1926, the Second World War, the Suez Crisis in the 1950s, the Falkland War. This does not mean reading a whole history book about each event. You may have noticed you do not have the time. But it is necessary to have a clear view of when these things happened and what their main implications were. So, for example, if I say to you, the Labour government of 1964 to 70, you should really, before the exam, you should really have a paragraph. You don't need to have 10 pages of information about this in your head, but you should really have several sentences of the big things they did, you know. Not necessarily all the big things, but some of them. And juries often complain that candidates focus too closely on the particular question, you know, what did the BBC do, without knowing what were the big changes which shaped what the BBC could do or what the BBC might do. I think this is also a little bit a question sometimes of students being very young. Yeah, it can be a little tempting, especially if you're not experienced in history, to think, oh, well, the 20th century was like that. and forget that every period had its own texture, but also was the 20th century, a year in the 20th century was just as long as a year in the 21st century. And as you know, over the last 2 years, a lot of things can happen. And so if you have if you're looking at things happening in the 50s, you just try to get the idea of people who have lived through the Second World War in Britain and the bombing and so on, and who are discovering a little bit of prosperity and a television, and it's really the enchantment of everyday life. Certainly you need to know who the main political parties are and how they changed. It makes a difference if the Labour Party is in government or the Conservative Party in government. It doesn't change everything, but it does make a difference. It's not surprising that the Conservative Party introduced commercial television. It's not it, and yeah, that's probably the main example I wanted to mention. So, more particular advice. Well, if you have an essay question, this dissertation, which of course is in English for the interne and in French for the externe. I think I'm correct. That's right. Yeah. So, for the moment, we're talking about the interne, but partly because this particular class is paid for by the rector, and partly because it's first. It's the 28th of January. Yeah, the 28th of January. But as you can imagine, the problems are the same. In English or in French, except that, of course, your English must be good. Now, there are, perhaps you know this already, do stop me if you have any questions. The subject proposed is always either a quotation or a concept. So, the BBC and competition, that's a concept, or what they call in French, une question notionnelle. Yeah? And I mentioned a few of these possible ones. I have no idea what the juries do. I'm very impressed that the jury. I know 10 members of the jury because, you know, it's a small world, and I never get any information about what is happening. Never, none. They're very, very good at their job, so that's good. But I mentioned a few examples. You know, the BBC and modernity. That's difficult but interesting. The BBC and women. That's perhaps not so difficult conceptually. Not so difficult, you know. Well, the BBC and competition was my favourite one. The BBC and government, again, not too difficult conceptually. The BBC and, yeah. Or it's a quotation. But in both cases, really, you should begin with definitions. Yeah, that is just, yeah, sorry, yes, I am looking at you. Okay. Yeah, so the BBC and competition, I would say, now, you have 7 hours, yeah, so you can spend 10 minutes thinking about, oh, so what exactly is competition? This is not easy, yeah, but do spend 10 minutes on it. Don't spend 30 seconds. You say, well, competition is when two people both want something. Yeah, okay. Well, you see, the thing about competition on the BBC is that there have been some forms of competition. The other advantage of defining the thing is it allows you to widen the question. So, for example, when you say BBC and competition, the first thing you think of is, you know, in 1955 they had commercial television, so the BBC wasn't very good, they turned over. That's the first example. And indeed, Asa Briggs, when he wrote his huge volumes of the history of the BBC, the volume about 1955 to 74, I think, is entitled Competition. So he obviously thought this was at the centre of BBC history for these 15 years. But really, you need to first of all think, oh, well, what? How can I make this wider? Well, first of all, there is other competition than the television, but I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say definitions first of all. Yes. So how does competition work? What does it mean when we talk about the BBC? Well, it's not the same as the competition. But I have a Monoprix supermarket down the road and a Franprix, and they are in traditional commercial competition. If I go to one, I won't go to the other. If I spend 100 euros at one, I would spend it at the other. So they're in direct competition. So what do? Sometimes they reduce their prices. Sometimes they increase their variety. Yeah, they fight. And the fight is very immediate. Yeah, if 100 customers go to one, then the other one loses money. This is not the case in the BBC. If the BBC in, let's say, 1964... If certainly, well, in the 50s, when commercial television came in, BBC viewership went right down. There were three times more people who preferred ITV in 1959 that's pretty bad. This did not lose money for the BBC immediately. It's not commercial competition. However, as I'm sure you can imagine, this competition for audiences was important because every 10 years, the government says, oh, well, let's look at the BBC. Shall we continue to order everybody in the country with a television to give you money every year? Well, if the BBC is getting less and less popular in all the newspapers, so, oh, yeah, well, why don't they privatise the BBC, the government? People don't want to watch it. Why don't they privatise it? It's no good. So a big political pressure. So, in fact, the competition experienced by the BBC is indirect through politics. So they must, if they are losing viewers, they must change, because they will cause themselves problems. However, they're not obliged to change this month. It's not like the supermarket. The supermarket, if they lose 10% of their customers, they have the national manager coming down to visit them Monday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, that's commercial competition is much harder. So that's the first kind of competition is explaining, I would explain at the beginning, how the standard competition with private television or with private radio works. The examples will come later. But you could say other things about competition. You could talk about, you're not obliged to talk about, other, you're obliged to talk about radio and television. You're obliged to talk about before the war and after the war. But if you wanted to, you could talk about competition inside the BBC, for money. In the 1980s, the budgets were going down. And the sports department would say, hey, we're more important than the drama department. There was also competition between women and men. And women were not paid so much. Yeah, so it would be possible to talk about that kind of competition too. Okay, I think that's probably all I have immediately. I will come back to. Oh dear, I'm clicking on the wrong thing. I will come back to that. But certainly begin by defining. The meaning of the terms is often not one-dimensional, but subject to interpretation, controversy, and disagreement. And in the video which I did today, which you haven't seen yet, I thought was important. Inform, educate, and entertain. We all know those words. Yeah, that's very BBC. And I realised that the meaning of inform, educate and entertain in 1922 was not the same meaning of inform, educate and entertain in 1970 or 1990. Yeah. What kind of things get into the news is much, much wider in 1980 than in 1920. Much more news about ordinary people. People on the streets, we interview people on the street. What was life like? What was it like for you when this happened to you? In the 1920s and 30s, this is impossible. We don't want these people in our radio studio. No, no, we have the voice of authority and that's it. Yeah? And so this is, information has changed. What is important has changed. So the amount of news about women, about working class people and about non-white people has gone up massively. Yeah, probably not enough, but yeah, definitely the rise of the democratic spirit, in my opinion, is a real thing. Secondly, educates. Well, at the beginnings, the educate was talks, yeah? Here is an expert, he's going to talk to you about the Renaissance. People were very happy because they didn't have any alternative, you know, they couldn't say, oh, I'm switch that off, I'm going to watch Netflix. Documentaries in the 70s and 80s were much more sophisticated. Reenactments of key scenes. Lots of film, aerial film of the hill where the battle took place, if it's about a battle. Much more sophisticated and rich to educate people. Education was supposed to be a little entertaining. Again, entertaining changed very much. And there's some very sophisticated... Well, as we know today... If you take a commercial company like Netflix, I think it would be very difficult to argue that there's no quality drama on there. There is. Of course, there's also some very silly stuff. That's life. But I don't think any, even university professors who are very, very strict people, I don't think there's anybody saying, oh, no, all of Netflix is all nonsense. It's all commercial nonsense. No, I don't think that's possible. Yeah, there's some very sophisticated. So even entertainment has changed. And of course, entertaining, if you take quiz programs. Now, quiz programs are entertainments. It's interesting, why do we like them? But of course, they can also be educational. I remember Mastermind, which is a British quiz show where you have a... They each choose a specialist subject. And so you also learn stuff. Let me take another... So that was just to say that some of these terms that we take for automatic... Make sure we're looking at them. What do they mean when they say public service? Public service, national interest, the interest of the people, broadcasting from below. They're all very, very different, yeah. When John Reith talked about public service, he didn't really think about it in a very democratic way. He didn't think, oh, let's ask people what they want. In fact, he was opposed to asking people what they wanted. Most people don't know what they want, and even less what they need. That's an actually quote from the guy. Another example, if you see have a term like elitism. Today, and even in 1995, this is it's a pretty negative sort of word. In the 20s and 30s, I don't think it would be. The BBC mentioned, yeah, we're elitist. That's because our ideas are better than everybody else. What's your problem? So elitism has been really changed. And this you can see also in education in Britain. Now, from 1945 until 1975, approximately, you had this system where you took an exam at 11 years old, the 11 plus, and you were sorted. Two-thirds of you to the secondary modern school, where you'll probably end up working with your hands. One-third of you to the grammar school. These are all free, and then we're not talking about private schools. You might end up at university. And this was interesting. So you took an exam at 11 years old. This was an IQ test, fundamentally. But the idea was that people are born the right sort of person to go to university, or the right sort of person not to go to university. So this is a very traditional idea. Today, we don't generally see things like that. So that was the sort of elitism which was very, very common. You know, so 11 years old, well, you know which ones need to go to university, which ones don't. Today, that would be quite shocking today, I think, if the government suddenly said, we're going to decide who goes to university at 11 years old. I think that would quite shock people today. But that was the sort of layering, classification, which was normal in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and disappeared in the later period. Okay, so begin by defining things regularly. Candidates rush off to say all they know about a given subject in chronological order, without taking the time to identify what is specific about this quotation or this notion. I've already said that. And of course, I think you've been told this before, but they say it again and again because they always have people who don't do it. And this is the paratext. So if you have a quotation and it says, New Statesman, 1984. Well, with a bit of luck, you know what kind of publication the New Statesman or the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mirror or the Listener or the Financial Times is, with a bit of luck. If you don't feel clear about this, I have two short videos on my YouTube channel, The Press in the UK. Now, it's about today, 2020, but in fact, the big actors are the same: The Sun, The Guardian, The New Statesman, The Economist, and so on. They last a long time, and so I do recommend that. Because certainly, if you have a quotation and it says Daily Telegraph, 1969, it's a pity if you don't know that the Daily Telegraph is the most conservative of the daily newspapers. It's a pity. And of course, you know, it's a pity. You know, you have to continue anyway. What is, in the paratext, what is the importance of the date mentioned? Before what, that doesn't mean you don't just copy the date out. Of course, you don't get any marks by writing, this is an article from the 4th of August, 1978. Yeah, and really, you would like every sentence to win you one little mark. Otherwise, you're wasting your sentence, yeah? And so instead of, you know, 1978, you say, shortly before the election of the Conservative government. You didn't win a big mark, but you won a little mark. You know, whereas it, when you copy 1978, you don't win any marks. You're just trying to put everything on your side. Of course, you don't go and give the date of birth of Margaret Thatcher. That's too much. Yeah, at what point, this quotation, at what point in the development of attitudes or processes, I just gave, I can't remember who I gave it to, but I just gave, yes, I gave to the Paris students a quotation from John Reith from 1925. And the important thing is that this was already his opinion before the BBC was a public service. So he was talking about public service while it was still a private company. So obviously, when you got this quotation from John Ruth in 1925, if you didn't mention that the BBC was still a private company, obviously that's not good. The paratext, so the paratext can be very good, yes. This is often, it's often not simple to explain the importance of the dates. So for a quotation about the BBC and education from the 1950s, don't hesitate to speculate a little bit. And I thought of writing, one might think that the optimism of the economic boom contributed to an optimistic view of mass education. Now, notice the very, very important expression here, one might think. Yeah, you should have at least two one might thinks in every essay. Yeah. Of course, I'm simplifying. That is to say, this is called hedging. Yeah, because a lot of history is not facts. It's things which are probably true, which point in a particular direction. And so I definitely recommend at least two one might think. I'm trying to make it easier for you. Informed speculation can show your understanding of social and historical processes in motion. And finally, about the chronological account, it is just about possible to write a good essay where the structure is chronological from the beginning to the end. It is possible. However, in general, the jury find that the student who has chosen to begin in 1922 and move through the decades is doing this because they haven't really thought of the central questions put forward in the question, and so they can't bring a structure. On the other hand, I don't recommend that your structure be too complex. Yeah. So, for example, for my own structure, now, of course, it's easier for me. I am old and I have been a historian for a long time. But what did I get? What did I decide on as my structure? I have it here somewhere. Yes. One, what different kinds of competition have acted on the BBC? Two, what effects did they have? Why? How did the BBC have to change because of the competition? Three, how did the BBC try to limit the arrival of competition? Now, this is not the structure, it's a structure, but it's fairly simple, yeah? And I do recommend fairly simple structures. Because you're told so much you need a structure and a problematique, we occasionally get students who have one, and in fact, it doesn't really mean anything. Yeah, so quite simple. Yeah. So this is like, you know, what kinds of competition came along? How did the BBC have to change because of them? And how did the BBC try to stop new kinds of competition from coming along? I've spoken a lot about the commissions of inquiry. But there's another side to this. Before every commission of inquiry, the BBC writes a document. This is what we would like to do in the next 10 years. If you are kind enough to renew our charter, please, Mr. Government, we love you. Yeah, approximately. And so they write them very, very carefully. Every 10 years, it is conceivable that the BBC could disappear. They write them very, very carefully, and they're not stupid. If they have a Conservative government, they underline, without seeming dishonest, they underline the kind of ideas which the Conservative government prefer. And on the other hand, if they have a Labour government, especially in the 40s and 60s, then they underline, you know, with, it's very It's very difficult to do, of course, but because you've got to sound sincere as well. But they write that these, and they work very hard at defending their position. And so far, I think there is something really tremendously interesting. Remember that British governments have privatised the railways. No sensible country in the world thinks it's a good idea to privatise the railways. And it was an absolute disaster. But no government has ever privatised the BBC. So they can be quite proud of that. And so it's interesting, of course. I often say the only interesting questions in history begin with the word why. So why, if Margaret Thatcher and then Tony Blair, but he's after our period, could privatise electricity and gas and begin the privatisation of the railways, finished under Tony Blair, begin the privatisation of pensions and so on, how did the BBC survive? There you go. Oh, I'm going back up where I was. Yeah. Just one last thing on mistakes of perspective. This is difficult when you're young. Yeah, life's so beautiful when you're young. That's the Jam said that. This is, you know, remember that 1922 to 95 is a long time. That is to say that, you know, governments are mostly interested in what will happen this year, and then they're a little bit interested in what will happen next year, and a little bit less interested in what will happen after the next election. This is normal, yeah? And so you mustn't think that decisions in 1963 were because of something that happened in the Second World War. That's not possible, because it's more intricate than that. And secondly, and this is something that you did, Charlotte, was a bit of a difficulty, really, and that is to say that the BBC monopoly lasted from 1922 till 1955 in television. From 1936 to 1955 in television, and from 1922 to 1973 in radio. This is an extremely long period. This is the period when all the different kinds of programme were invented, where the government changed several times, and there was a war. And in many ways, the first 50 years of broadcasting is a longer period than the second 50 years. I know that sounds silly, because 50 years is 50 years. But in the first 50 years, everything was invented. And all the structures and the arguments and so on were invented. And so it's more period. Just like if you think of the bicycle is very old now. But even the bicycle, you know, when were the big changes in bicycles? In the last 20 years, not such big changes, really. But in the first 20 years of the bicycle, huge changes. Yes, so that's why it really is a very long period. That's difficult. I was quite amused, Charlotte, because Charlotte was saying 33 years is not a long time. How old are you? What are you, 33 years? That's more than half my life, you know. Where were you 33 years ago, Charlotte? I had a good laugh about that. So I'm not attacking you, Charlotte. I'm sure you understand that. Okay. Do you any questions there? Okay. Well, I'll keep going. So, summarise some of the comments from recent jury reports, and then I'm going to look at. I have a what I would say. Now, of course, what I would say is. I have an advantage, but I've tried to produce an answer which will help you to imagine yours, rather than one which intimidated, which is intimidating. Now, your English should be relatively formal, and colloquial turns of speech are not appropriate. A couple of people recently in the translation, I think. Was it in the translation? No, it was in a dissertation, yeah? Used the intensifier pretty. It was pretty difficult for the BBC. No. Pretty as an intensifier is for speaking. You don't write that. The same thing with way. This was way too difficult for the new Director General. No. This is too informal. So your English should be relatively formal, and colloquial turns of speech are not appropriate. You're expected at the beginning to present your approach or key question. That's how we say in English, problematique. We don't do this in English. In England, we don't do this in England. But if we did, we would call it a key question. And the structure of your dissertation, like I just did with mine. You will then develop your dissertation keeping to the announced structure. They don't like it when you announce one structure and then use another. They really don't like that. Also, it's easier said than done, but you need to avoid a vague description of a structure in which the themes of one section and another are in reality interchangeable. Secondly, the conclusion. The conclusion summarizes what answers you are suggesting for your key question, or what analyses become clear from the approach you have chosen. And the conclusion may also highlight which questions are controversial and much debated and we don't really have an answer for. That's absolutely fine. If you show you are opening questions which you can't close, that's fine. You're allowed to do that. But certainly, if in your conclusion, we cannot guess what your problematique was, that's not good. It sometimes means the problematique was not very good, or that you didn't look back at it. Yeah, but really, it should come back and say, okay, well, I have shown that there were more kinds of competition attacking the BBC than people thought. This is for my structure. I have shown that it was effective, and programming changed, and structure changed, and management changed because of the competition. And I have shown that the BBC could sometimes have some success limiting the arrival of new forms of competition. Now, yeah, I'm not at all claiming that my essay is perfect in any way. I only have a limited amount of time to do it. Jury reports have generally underlined the importance of avoiding a simple recounting of event. It must be clear how each event presented is linked with the general flow of the dissertation. And that means that every two or three paragraphs says, another way the BBC limited competition is. Yeah. And so that we can say, oh yes, sir, I remember how it goes. This makes it easy to read it. Now, of course, this is difficult, but you only have to do better than the others. You don't have to be brilliant or anything. Is that reassuring? Maybe not. Okay. It is also important to remain within the chronological limits imposed by the program. You may mention events before 1922 or after 1955. Three sentences about an event before 1922, no problem if it fits. Or an event after 95, no problem. But there should not be an entire paragraph about anything before 1922 or after 1995. You need to make sure you can correctly spell the main proper names associated with BBC history. John Reith, William Haley, Alasdair Milne, Hugh Green, John Burt, Radio Normandy, Radio Calendar, Caroline, Pilkington, Ulswater, Peacock, and so on. Yeah. All the Director Generals and all the Commissioners of Inquiries, you must not spell them wrong. They really don't like this, yeah? You've got to get that. And it's not so hard to do. Also, notice that it is traditional in historical writing not to use honorific titles. So it's traditional in historical writing to say John Reith decided this and not Sir John Reith. This is because we're looking at his role in the historical process. And at one point he became Sir John Reith, but that's not... That's not our concentration. If you write him a letter, well, he's dead, but if you write him a letter, you can write, Dear Sir John Reith. But we normally don't. That's not a massively important thing, but it's the tradition. You don't put Sir John Reith, you know. It's like, you don't write Her Majesty the Queen, you just write the Queen. Historical analysis, as I'm sure you know, and I am repeating myself, but that's what I paid to do, does not tend to come up with fixed or black and white answers. For this reason, it will be essential for you to know how to hedge. Hedging is the use of... Sorry. Hedging is the use of cautious phrasing or expressions, which underline the fact that you do understand that the solidity of a particular statement is open to question. To do this is a real advantage at aggregation level. There are many ways of hedging. It seems that BBC programme quality gained a solid international reputation. And again, notice that I didn't say BBC programmes were the best quality. It's difficult to prove. The BBC has an international reputation for high quality programmes. That's true. If you search on Google BBC high quality, you'll find thousands and thousands of newspaper articles from around the world saying the BBC is really good quality. So the best thing for you as an aggregation student to do is not to write the BBC has high quality programmes, but to write the BBC has a high reputation of quality. Modals are also extremely useful. Those who do not agree with this vision might object that the BBC tends to defend the priorities of the elite. And so if you've written something saying how open the BBC is and how they allow, for example, the Wednesday play in the 1970s, they allow radical content as well as conservative content, they're very open. And then you want to say, well, yes, but some people don't agree. You said, those who are more critical may point out that content, including non-white people, was very slow to enter the BBC television. That's a perfectly reasonable statement there. Because gradually in the BBC, you got more and more diverse and multicultural content, but it was rather slow. Remember the first BBC BBC woman newsreader, and then the second one was 8 years later, and the third, today the BBC is probably more advanced than the French television on the screen, but it wasn't fast. You cannot say, oh, the BBC worked hard to push women forward. That's just not true. The BBC adapted eventually, and again, as you can say, critics might point out that. It's very good. Critics might point out that. And the same thing is, most commentators suggested that. It's very good. Rather than... you don't want to express too many opinions as if they were facts. Like I say, the BBC has high-quality programmes. I don't know. Yeah. Because people don't agree. I mean, you saw the different books which I've looked at, and that book by Thomas so-and-so, the BBC, The Myth of a Public Service. Well, that's normal. It's a democratic country. If you take the question of racism, on the one hand, if you look at the soap opera, I've already gone through this, if you look at the soap opera EastEnders, and how they really worked hard to bring a black family into the street, which was a massively popular program. A lot of people who were, let's say, not anti-racist, would, be thinking about things in a slightly different way because of EastEnders. And on the other hand, the same BBC allowed a very racist program like the Black and White Minstrel Show. When you study history, contradictory is normal. My slogan is always, I think contradictory is the word you're looking for. That's what I want this on my tombstone, sur ma pierre tombale. I think contradictory is the word you're looking for. Not soon. Much, much later. Of course, you need to be careful with the language. Of course, you need to be careful with the language and correctness and so on. I don't know. I've never done a 7-hour essay in my life. And I don't know how much spare time you have. Certainly, you don't leave the room before the 7 hours are up. That's just stupid. If you have time, your last reread is, I am now going to look at every verb to check it is correct. There's a verb. Oh, yeah, that's okay. There's a verb. Yeah, that's okay. That's from military. Yeah. I don't know if you end up with spare time or not. No. Is there anybody here who did it last year? Yeah, did you have spare time at the end of the... No. Did you finish? Oh, yeah, she did finish. It is difficult, yeah. So you have 7 hours to prepare the question. You first need to spend time brainstorming the different relevant aspects that you can show knowledge of understanding. Just, you know, spend a few minutes. What different aspects could I look at? A high quality answer will generally show a broad understanding. So in the case of the present question, I already said at the BBC in competition, if you talk only about commercial television in the 50s, that's bad. Even if what you say is excellent, that's not enough. Analysing the question and so on. Okay, so what have I got here? From different decades, adapted for back. Yes. So in my dissertation on this question, which bizarrely enough is in French because I prepared it for the Excel, I use a whole series of examples. I think I use 20 examples. That's not bad. There are hundreds of examples you could use. You could write an excellent essay and never use any of my examples. That's probably not true, because I think in the example of the 30s, the 1930s, where the BBC was getting worried because of Radio Normandie and Radio Luxembourg, I think that's probably the most difficult one to avoid, because in the 30s that was the problem of competition. Of course, if it says the BBC in competition, that includes writing about the BBC not having competition. So why did they establish the monopoly? They began, you've got a monopoly. Why? There were two basic reasons. One was the technology, that is, that there were not many frequencies to be had. And the other was the example of America, where most of the British elites were convinced that the American solution of sponsored programmes and many, many radio channels all in competition did not produce good programmes. This is difficult to prove. Certainly, it's true that the American model did not produce radio channels which broadcast a lot of classical music and opera. And this was something important for the British elites. I think the British elite has always found culture extremely, like in France, which is not necessarily the case in some of the in America and in Australia, for example. In Britain, we always like to mock the Americans for not being cultural enough. It's probably not true, yeah. But there's the whole joke of the American who says to the British, "What do you think is the main difference between the British and American?" And the British gentleman says, "Well, I think you're much more interested in money, and we're much more interested in culture." And the American said, "That's not true. Here in Chicago, we have a symphony orchestra that costs over $1 million. There you go, joke of the day. Wasn't that funny? Oh, well, it used to be funny. I get on to, don't hesitate if you have questions. So this is what I said, and my introduction. In a society often referred to as a market society, competition is almost everywhere, and its influence on a public service of cultural broadcasting is a fundamental aspect of the history of the BBC. I'm translating, but maybe I should read it in French. I think I'll read it to you in French. Of course, it will be in English for the Intel, but I prefer it for the Extern, and I can't translate immediately. Dans une société que l'on appelle souvent une société de marché, la concurrence est un principe quasi omniprésent. Et son influence sur un service public de diffusion culturelle constitue un aspect fondamental de l'histoire de la BBC. Je propose de commencer par déterminer quels sont les différents types de concurrence qui agissent sur la BBC tout au long du XXe siècle. Ensuite, j'examinerai les effets de cette concurrence en prenant quelques exemples tirés de différentes périodes historiques concernant avant tout les adaptations décidées par les responsables de la BBC. Enfin, je regarderai les arguments et les actions de la BBC qui visent à limiter la place de la concurrence dans son domaine d'activité. Quels sont les arguments déployés dans le débat public à l'encontre de l'idée que la concurrence est toujours et partout un procédé sain et utile? À partir des années 70, ce débat se situe dans une époque où la montée du néolibéralisme rend plus délicate la défense d'un espace non concurrentiel. Okay, so what I tried to do at the beginning was to widen the question. So here I have a space to talk about the pirate radios of the 60s, Radio Normandy in the 30s, ITV and the new television. I can talk about all that. I can also talk about the debates, not just about the actions and the counteractions, but also about the debate. What were, for example, the debate in the 50s with the Popular Television Association on one side and a whole series, a whole section of the elite on the other. And this debate, which was very simplistic. On the one hand, people said, the BBC is the best because they're high quality and they educate people. And on the other hand, people said, ITV is the best because it's more fun and the BBC is boring and ITV gives people what they want. This is an extremely simplistic form of the debate. The idea that you can give people what they want is rather strange, really, because what did people want on television in 1950? They had never seen a television. They had no idea what they wanted. It was a completely new thing. And so, in fact, although the BBC cannot decide what people will want, individuals cannot decide what they want either. It's a much more complex thing than that. So the aim of my introduction was to make sure I had a chance to say quite a lot of what I know. Now, of course, it's easier for me. I have been studying the BBC since October 2019, because I invented the question. But I didn't know. Before October 2019, I knew much less than you about the BBC. But on the other hand, I have not had to study Henry James and Shakespeare and all that at the same time. So I have an advantage over you. Okay, so that's my beginning, and really my I'm trying to see how the structure comes in there. I can't remember now. Yeah, because my key question is, how was the BBC changed by competition? And that's my key question is, how was the Je structurerai cette dissertation autour de la question de savoir les changements causés dans la BBC à cause de la concurrence. Les premières années de la radio, dans les années 20, sont marquées par un fait majeur, qui est l'évitement de la concurrence de marché. La mise en place de la British Broadcasting Company en 1922 vise à éviter une situation comme celle que connaissaient les États-Unis, dans laquelle une concurrence relativement sans entrave semblait poser une série de problèmes, tant en ce qui concerne l'encombrement des fréquences qu'en matière de qualité de programme. La mise en place de la corporation quelques années plus tard, avec interdiction des publicités, un monopole du droit à émettre et un système de financement basé sur une taxe forfaitaire poursuit le même but tout en assurant une certaine surveillance politique d'un service qui devait, on commençait à le comprendre, devenir un vecteur essentiel de la formation de l'esprit des citoyens, comparable en puissance au système éducatif. C'est vachement bien, hein ? Vous ne trouvez pas ? Bon. Voilà, je vais continuer. La BBC n'a jamais eu à subir la concurrence de marché direct, où il faut maximiser les profits et utiliser tous les moyens possibles afin de gagner des parts de marché et pour empêcher d'autres d'en prendre. La publicité, le secret technologique, les soldes, les réductions de prix, les dispositifs de fidélisation des clients, la centralisation du capital et la création d'un monopole, pour n'en nommer que quelques-uns. Évidemment, on s'attend. Je suis historien depuis 40 ans. Évidemment, on ne s'attend pas à ce que vous produisez des paragraphes comme ça. Mais je voulais pas trop le complexifier. Mais je voulais pas non plus ne pas dire ce que j'avais à dire. La situation de la BBC est fort différente. Elle fournit un service qui est financé par une taxe, la redevance. Elle ne contrôle pas le prix de ce service. C'est le gouvernement qui le fixe. Ok, donc vous voyez, you can see that I'm trying to look in some detail at the situation of the BBC. It's not competition in the normal way like a butcher's or a baker's or a candlestick maker's or Amazon. Because it gets the money from the government. But let's go into the detail. It gets the money from the government. How much money? One. The same amount of money from everybody who has a television. That's going to be politically delicate. If you pay council tax, what used to be the rates in Britain, la taxe d'habitation, if you have a big house, you pay a lot. And if you have a small house, you pay a bit. If you pay income tax, in Britain or in France, if you have a huge salary like mine, then you pay a lot. It's not that. I don't pay that much. I deserve to pay so much, that much. If you have a small salary like yours, then you pay a bit. Okay, I'm getting carried away. So this idea that the redevance, that the lease license fee should be the same for everybody, is politically complicated. A lot of people say, well, what's this nonsense? We can keep the BBC, but people can choose. You want the BBC, okay, you pay a subscription to the BBC, just the same as Netflix. This was discussed, especially in the 50s and 60s. Yeah, like Netflix, it's there if you want to. And later on, because people realised that there were some things a public service will do which a commercial channel finds very difficult, they had other more complicated ideas. For example, let's have a minimum public service doing the Open University and the news and a few things, you know, maybe just a few hours a day. And then the rest of the BBC you can only have if you pay a subscription. And then we don't have to make people pay a licence fee. It's not fair. Everybody paying the same, poor people paying the same as rich. You can see that it has the potential to be controversial. Yeah. So what's important here is to remember, because I think you knew these things about the licence fee, but it's very often easy to forget to put them in your essay and just say, oh, well, yeah, the licence fee. Yeah, but the licence fee, how much is the licence fee? The government decides to raise it. They could decide to reduce it. Generally, the BBC goes along to the government and says, OK, at the moment it's £100. We would like it to be £150 because look at all these wonderful plans we have to do with the money. And the government says, well, £110. Yeah. Because that's what governments do, of course. They have other pressures. And so all this goes on. Pendant très longtemps, jusqu'aux années 1950 en ce qui concerne la télévision et jusqu'en 1973 en matière de radio, elle jouit d'un monopole. Aucune autre organisation nationale n'a le droit d'émettre. Notez bien ce qui est marqué, ça me rappelle ce qu'il faut faire quand on a oublié une date. N'hésitez pas de dire au début des années 70, assez rapidement après la guerre. Si vous trouvez plus, si c'est 46 ou 47, ce n'est pas un problème. Si vous mettez, voilà, dans au début de la période d'après-guerre, that's not a problem. So this is a normal way to do it, you know. And certainly, do not learn. The Television Act was passed on the 27th of October 1954. Don't waste your headspace, your brain space with this, because it doesn't matter that it was passed in October and not in May. It doesn't matter. It could matter. It might matter. For example, in 1974, you have a Conservative government in January and a Labour government in April. So in an exceptional situation, it could be important that it was January and not April. But in general, you know, this is just detail that you don't know. Now, I know you have had an extremely long day, and so I'm going to stop because it is 6 o'clock. There are more videos coming up on the blog. There are going to be a little bit more videos than there were supposed to be because I can't talk any faster. But I think that's fine. If you remember questions when you've gone, then just send me an email, and that will keep me keep my brain going. And we have another methodology class next Wednesday. It's tomorrow we have a dem, and we're going to be looking at the problems of rich people and when they can only afford 32 square meters in Paris. Okay. Thank you, and you now deserve a rest. And of course, Happy New Year and bonne santé à tous. You may leave. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Now click on this button and you will all disappear.